Take the shoes off your feet, for the ground on which you're standing is holy ground. Or, fear not, for behold. Or, and I saw a new heaven and a new earth. These are typical of the many kinds of proclamations, announcements, experiences that we associate with the sacred in the Old and New Testaments, the biblical tradition. And we could find counterparts in many others. For those of you who are new, yesterday we talked about this as the sacred, as having two dimensions. Rilke says, beauty is but the beginning of terror. The two interrelate. The sacred shatters us and heals us. It makes great demands upon us and soothes us. We cannot contain it. It calls us to the God who is beyond all the other beyonds. We don't know quite what to do with it. In our discussion, we found that for some of you, the sacred is most apparent in the nature around us, which inspires awe and wonder. It reduces us and inspires us. For others, we heard it was experiences of life. It might be childbirth. It might be a breakthrough in counseling or whatever, in which you found the deepest things about the human person. For others, it was a scripture or a religious experience of an open confrontation with the God who is beyond and who cannot be taken captive or whatever. And from that, I propose that at least these five things go on when we take the shoes off our feet on holy ground, or ask not to fear though they kept on fearing, or when we see a new heaven or a new earth. One, we confront an other, capital O, who defines us and is over against and beckons. Second, this leads us to feel set apart. It demands response. Third, there's an impartation of a secret. Normally, people who are in range of the sacred want to share it with others. It's too much to bear. They want to share it with others. It's too exciting not to bear. They share it with others because they profit from what others have experienced. And fourth, this empowers them. It empowers them by giving them a sense that they are in on something, a secret that they must put to work. And finally, they are then agents of the sacred. You, your people, the elect, the chosen, those who've had the experience. That was yesterday, and I don't know why it took me 45 minutes to do what I just did in two. But that's the background to tonight, because I said that all sacred involves risk. It's dangerous, it leads some to kill. It's marvelous, it leads some to heal. I hope there aren't people who are only going to hear my killing side tonight, because the healing is my favorite. But the two come together in our response to the sacred, and we must do justice to both. Tonight, why it is that some people and groups in response to the sacred, genuinely and sincerely, then close off, develop what I'm calling hard line. An autobiographical moment, a little bit trickles out from each of us speakers every day, to describe how these two come up. For one, I have been involved now for 6.5 years in the most extensive study of comparative fundamentalisms around the world. We've involved 150 scholars. We've published 3 of 6 enormous volumes. Every day I am sacredly bound to wave a book in front of you for the sake of our compact with the bookstore. Tonight it's The Glory and the Power, the Fundamentalist Challenge to the Modern World. I co-authored it with my associate in the project, R. Scott Appleby. Photos by Micah Marty, who's here. This is only 3 of the fundamentalists: American Protestantism, the West Bank Jews of Israel, and Muslims in Egypt. But if you're interested in fundamentalism, this is a kind of a digested version of the great big thing. All the while I'm doing that, I've been involved with the Park Ridge Center for the Study of Health, Faith, and Ethics, which is a healing institution. And somebody once said, Marty only gets interested in the sacred when it kills or it heals. And so you're going to get both of them tonight. The one studies all those movements around the world in which people, having been in contact with the sacred, feel that they are called as agents to act in the name of the sacred over against from behind a hard line. That's where most people in the world get their stories of religion these days. It's hard to get the media to cover the stories of churches doing healing, of volunteer work in the city. The modern city really works because of the volunteers that are out there. That doesn't make a story. What makes story is Hindu fundamentalists kill Muslim fundamentalists, or Egyptian fundamentalist Islamic Shiite sect bombs World Trade Center, or whatever. So that's the side that usually gets shown. We're going to do a little justice to that, I hope, tonight. The killing response, the hard line. Nota bene. Not all the killing I'm talking about is literally killing. We have a saying at our house that whenever people use the word literal, they don't mean it. You know, this afternoon it literally rained cats and dogs, is our way of knowing it did not literally rain cats and dogs. Well, literally, not all killing is killing, literally. Looks can kill. Words can kill. Closing off of the circle can kill. Diminishing the spirit can kill. Ruling out can kill. And there are many people who have been in a family fight, a congregation fight, a denomination fight, a party fight, and they found up close that there's no blood on the floor, but it can be terribly damaging to the spirit when hard lines are drawn. And the access to the sacred has often produced this. For the Greeks, it's Mars. For Egypt of old, the ordinary people spend their whole lives aggrandizing the Pharaoh. We can't duck it in Israel, Yahweh the warrior. Jesus, the one of peace, is cast in the Gospels against a background of conflict and Armageddon. By the fourth Christian century, we were flying the flags and executing God's war. World War I, Gottstrafe England, and God save the king, God this and God that and God the other thing. Good God, you've got your work cut out for you, was one of the prayers of 1918, because all sides always claim Yahweh the warrior as the sacred blesser of our traditions. So a lot of people go looking elsewhere. Maybe it's nice with the Buddha. There was an Emperor Ashoka once who had a very benign and soft-line decree. And so we think if only we could forget about Judaism and Christianity, we would find access to the sacred that never turns hard line. But what is always interesting to me is that there's never anybody beyond Ashoka in the tradition who was brought up. And Hindus have a very good name because they have a religion that's supposed to absorb all the others along the way. But if anybody else along the way speaks up, you find that it's capable of hard lines as well. If somebody suggests that there's been access to the sacred and there's no hard line anywhere, don't believe them, or please come running to me because I need a footnote for an exception. And it can go very close to home. It can happen, as I say, in local churches. The root of the conflict when hard lines are drawn by two sets of people who sincerely and genuinely have had some experience of the sacred. Some years ago, I reproduced something in a newsletter, which I got more letters from people saying that was the most comforting thing they'd seen in a long time. Some minister had written in praise of gossip in the congregation. He said he'd been in three congregations where there'd been no gossip, and now he's in the fourth one where there was gossip. And it was very disturbing to him at first until somebody said, well, the other three places, nobody even cared enough about each other to talk about them behind their back. You're at least transcending apathy. So think of that as a little comfort. Some drawings of some lines are at least an indication of a passion, and the sacred always awakens passion. So today, I often quote Harold Isaacs in a book called Idols of the Tribe. Around the world, there is a massive, convulsive ingathering of peoples, ethnic cleansing, into their separatenesses and over-againstnesses, hardline, to protect their pride and power and place from the real or presumed threat of other people who are doing the same. And almost always it's in the name of God or the sacred. Sometimes it's the root, sometimes it's just attached. But think of the party lines that go. I'll just name places. Northern Ireland, Western Europe, Folk is back and Blut is back. The former Soviet Union, Azerbaijan, Armenia, Central Asian Republics, Afghanistan, 30, 40 years, they say they'll be fighting each tribe. Pakistan, India, North Africa, Algeria, the Sudan, Egypt, Arab-Israeli, Latin America, the death squads, now heating up Protestant-Catholic fights. USA, not much bloodshed on the floor, but we have our tribes and our hard lines. What do they have in common? And why is it that we are spending so much time these days trying to understand hardlining in religion? A month ago, we were in Salzburg for a two-week meeting on ethno-nationalism. What is it with these tribes, these hardliners? Harry could reproduce for you an evening when we had representatives from the 7 former Yugoslavias. We had Montenegrins and we had Serbians and Croatians who can't talk to each other at home. They're shooting each other there. And here they were across from each other. And we had South Africa and we had Albania and we had Northern Ireland. All the hot spots had somebody there. And one of the 14 days, they asked me to speak on religion and ethno-nationalism. And by evening, they had me signed up for a week of it next year because everybody came running up and said, that's the one nobody talks about, and that's what it's all about. It isn't always about boundaries. It's about memories and hatreds of people who claim that their tribe is the sacred one, that their memories are the sacred ones, that their Allah or Yahweh or Lord or ancestors impel them to be the agents because they've experienced the other, that they have the secret that the others don't have, that they are empowered. The biblical text about waiting on the Lord is rarely the part picked up by this side. They are the elect. Of my 5 talks, this is the one I think is the riskiest. I mentioned yesterday, it's the easy talk to think it's about them versus us. Somebody else's problem and not ours. And since it will become rather clear that I don't like most things about most hardline religion, I don't have a natural sympathy for it, I want to say a few things that I hope will at least even the playing field a little bit. First of all, one should pay tribute to some places where people are hardliners. I don't mean just draw a hard line. Every life must do that. Martin Luther King is a very benign reconciler. Yet he had to say, this I can't cross. There is a higher law than a law. We all look for that in any life with integrity. But when I talk about hardline here, I'm talking about a complete closing off of all other signals. And a little bit of tribute to that, one thing we have to notice is 72 years of Soviet Union attempt to expel religion and diminish religion and persecute religion and kill religion. Those who outlasted the Soviet Union were hardliners, after all. Jehovah's Witnesses and Baptists and Pentecostals of various sorts who were absolutely enclosed. There could be no other truth, including no other Christian truth, and they dug in embassy basements and in little cells or wherever. There is something about it that can withstand even the totalitarianisms of the day, so we don't just dismiss them when they're seen as a counterforce. Sometimes people who have been in the range of the sacred may misuse it somehow, but it also can be used. Second, not only hardline religion kills, you can suffocate with softness. You can bore with softness. You can let people lose direction and thus lose themselves with soft religion. So just to say soft and heal and vulnerable doesn't mean it. They can often be sneaky ways to dominate and control and manage. So not only hardline kills. Not all hardline kills. The Amish are hardline, and they haven't heard a flea that I've heard of. They have to have the ACLU defend them in court. They won't even defend themselves. And yet they're hardline, and there's some cruel things. If husband is under the ban, a wife can't sleep with him or pray with him or converse with him. Pretty cruel part of hardline. But as far as the rest of the outside world is concerned, this is not something you wake up in the morning and say, the Amish are coming, the Amish are coming. Killing is not the only business of the hardline. They saw the sacred. They heard the sacred word. They acted holistically, and this is part of it. For example, 1970s, early 80s, in the war with Iran and Iraq, we would read stories of mothers who would send their 10 and 12-year-old sons out in human chains to walk across landmines so they'd be exploded so the troops could go over and pursue the other side. And this was often presented as if they were inhumane, less humane mothers. If you know anything about their world, they cried as much as any parent would here. They cared as much, probably had as much investment in that child as anybody could have. It was their future. But they had first been healed by Islam. They got the times of the day, the rhythms of life, the hopes, the belonging, and they felt that was being intruded upon. So they acted, and the hardline killing was only a part of a way of life, some of which has a better side to it. Hardline can produce healing. I've known young people who were on drugs who find their way back or are found by an encounter which to most of us would be hardline. They've been living in a life where the stimuli can't be halfway. I'm very interested in the religion of the National Football League. There's very little softline religion there. When they get religion, they're born again and they're pretty dogmatic about it. And as they describe their life, you see why. The temptations, the seductions, the lures of big money, of sex, of lost way of life. And they're not real interested, one of them said, in the religion of maybe a little of this and maybe a little of that. They're in the trenches. And if I'm a little lighthearted about it, I'm trying merely to set up analogs in your minds to suggest that there can be a summoning of resources which demands a harder line. And last of all, as the preliminary, I don't equate being hard line and having convictions. That is, many hardline people have profound convictions, though some psychologists will tell you that the hard line is the covering up of a void in life because we lack certain convictions. Eric Heller, the great longshoreman philosopher, wrote a book called The True Believer, in which he argued, for example, that much love of orthodoxy was not love of truth, it was rather mutual suspicion. You didn't necessarily love truth that much, but you're nervous about whether everybody else in your group saw the sacred the way you did. But I don't like the notion that conviction is hardline and hardline is conviction. Absence of conviction leaves you very vulnerable. You can have a faith that is mingled with ambiguity and paradox and doubt and have conviction. I don't think that the alternative to hardline is mere tolerance. Tolerance is the virtue, somebody says, that you have if you don't believe in anything very much, you can't picture anything being very important to anybody else, so we don't care very much what you believe or what we believe. That's a very weak virtue. I've liked Gabriel Marcel's word, counter-intolerance. That is, you have enough conviction that you can use your awareness of what the convictions mean to you as a base for a relationship to other people who have such profound convictions that you're not likely soon to change. You're tempted to kill, to draw the hard line, to persecute, to exclude, to rule out, but then you use the depth of your own conviction as a warrant for their life, their security. Some years ago, I wrote a book on the on an aphorism. I made up the aphorism, so I'm quoting myself, which is a very vain and stupid, dumb thing to do. But I liked it and I agree with it. The problem in our society is that the highly committed people are not very civil, and the highly civil people aren't very committed. So it isn't, therefore, that the goal should be do in the hardliners and we'll have everything soft, but rather that we should ask the ways in which those places where you take a stand in life, having seen the sacred, which beckons and calls, fits into a life which includes also openness to other people, to other responses, because you never know from where the sacred is going to come. I think hardline has come in basically two forms in our time. One, hardline A, response to the sacred, is in a way passive. It lets others alone. It is hard on oneself. Puritanism, Jansenism, many such movements I like to call an aristocracy of morals. Have you ever noticed how most people think everybody thinks they'd like to be hedonists? The slippery slope, if you let things go a little bit, everything will slide down, right, into wallowing in the pigsty and all that stuff. No, there is something in humans that likes to meet demands. Why are you people out there jogging all the time if not? doing Tai Chi, going through spiritual exercises, there is in us very often an impulse to draw lines. And some of them get very hard, but Puritanism had soft edges. You should see the beer bills, the delinquency lists, the illegitimacy lists. They didn't all wear a scarlet letter either. They're accepted back into community. Puritanism had other things going, but it was essentially a kind of a long pool view of a hard line. And many of you had a grandparent of that sort, right? I talked to a lot of you already, and you had a grandparent or a parent, or you are a parent, who drew hard lines all the time. And then you find out about a month before they die in their upper 80s that they really were nice, soft people all the while. But somebody in church told them that's the way to be, or that's how they were brought up, or in the old country they did it, or in the Depression you had to do it, right? Very often that didn't really hurt a lot of people an awful lot, and it gave a certain integrity to their life. You could trust them. You got your day's work out of them, or whatever. This is hardline A, which we've all seen in the access to the sacred, and maybe we have some of it in us. Maybe we should hope to. Hardline B, I think, is the kind that is confusing in the world today. The one that produces those headlines, the one that does most of the killing. For example, the example of fundamentalisms. This grows out of a project of the American Academy of Arts and Sciences, which got the largest grant in their history, $3 million a few years ago, to study international public policy. And they should pick that issue that troubled them most. And they picked world fundamentalisms and then asked me to do it. I always have to say, I don't get a penny of that $3 million, just in case you think you should sidle up here. It's mainly jet fare for 150 scholars from 40-some nations. But why were they concerned? Because the American Academy of Arts and Sciences is a group of professors, scientists, and artists, almost all of whom have thought for two centuries that religion is going to disappear, or at least there's going to be a lot less of it every year. And the second thing they all believed is that whatever survived would be softer and softer and softer and more compromising, and it would just sort of dissolve and they'd be like us. And all of a sudden they wake up and find there's as much religion as ever on prime time and front page. Our State Department is far more worried about people who claim access to the sacred and draw hard lines than they are about what's left of the old Soviet Union or whatever. So the religion that survived didn't turn out to be all that tolerant either. In open competition almost anywhere in the world, it's outstripping the softer versions of religion. Why? Why, when we look at the sacred now, do so many people turn this way? I think it's a response to sudden change. The Iron Curtain is down only a few minutes, and you find that underneath it, all of these ethno-religious ferments had been there. They'd been nurturing their gods in secret, and now they bring them out into the open. They feel a holy call, jihad, the Islamic word for a holy cause, which we translate holy war. They're ready for it. A colleague of mine, Marvin Zonis, said at a joint meeting recently, for all the years of my adult life, I could wake up in the morning and the world was neatly arranged. Here were we, and there was the Soviet Union, and we better be armed. And we had to be smart enough to know they better not do anything, and they had to be smart enough to know we better not do anything, and all of a sudden they're gone. And we don't know what to believe in now. And neither does anybody in the space between us or there either. But that's modernness, and it hits us. Yesterday when I talked about the sacred, holy ground, the profane is out there, I was implying a world in which you knew the boundary. That mountain, these trees, our lake, that cathedral, this tomb of the unknown soldier. These were sacred spaces and you knew where they ended and where the profane started. Modernity pays no attention to that, pays no attention to it. The boundaries are gone. Each bleeds into the other. The profane is in the temple, and the sacred has to take its risk out there in the larger order. Why? For a lot of reasons that we like. We separated church and state. Who doesn't like that? I do. But the minute you did, you were in effect said, things can go on out there the same way, whether or not people have a sense of the sacred. Right? U.S. Constitution makes that pretty clear. We separate ethnicity and religion. To be a Jew for millennia simply meant that you had a Jewish mother. You couldn't not be a Jew. Now you've got books that say, why I choose to be a Jew. I happen to be a Lutheran means my great-grandparents used to believe something and I haven't ever quite signed off out of it. I'm of the Methodist tradition means they used to sing wonderful hymns and I haven't forgotten them all yet. You can be distanced no matter what your ethnic tie is. You have freedom to choose. Choice is a big part of modernity, and that's really scary. In the United States, hard lines got formed in the movement that gave the world the word fundamentalism when different accounts of human origins came in a century ago, evolution. Different accounts of human destiny came in, progress, or Marxism, which was a faith about the future. Over against that, they developed a whole new end of the world theory. Biblical criticism, you use the profane theories of regular literature on the sacred text. And you had to convert secular literature into the sacred. A lot of people treat ordinary literature as the sacred today and not the sacred scriptures. Those lines bleed, and boy, does that confuse people. Or another part of modernity. It's easier to speak of the sacred when all of the people have the same experience. Hear, O Israel, the Lord our God is one Lord. Everybody's called to that. You at least know who's got the idols. But we have an invention in the modern world, which we like, I do, called pluralism, which means there are a lot of different kinds of people around here. And what does that do to the sacred? Somebody said in the 19th century, it was easy to send missionaries to the bad Buddhists, but it's very confusing when you have a good Buddhist next door, because they're not living by your sense of the sacred, and yet they're producing good life, better than some of the people who've shared your sacred. So pluralism is a problem. You have to ethnically cleanse the neighborhood. Relativism. Modernity comes at you. You knew what the sacred was. Moses could come down and tell the people. Isaiah could go out and talk to the people. In Christendom, they could talk to the people. In early America, they knew who they were. In the modern world, there's a total challenge to the sacred because there's so many truths out there. And if everything's true, maybe everything's false. And so we all, what Peter Berger says, we all negotiate with modernity. Everybody does. The Amish do it minimally. They now put a little red phosphorescent triangle on the back of the buggy so they don't get hit on the expressway. Indiana says it's a law too, but they won't do it for that reason. They negotiate with modernity. Everybody does. If you're a parent, you've done it a long time. If you're an offspring, you did it with your parents. I like to keep track of the hardline cultures. 24 years ago, we were Holden Village, and they did real radical things like folk mass and jazz mass. They were bringing modern music into the temple. And all the fundamentalists and evangelicals and Pentecostals and conservatives said, that's pagan, that's terrible, it's the devil's beach, you'll use your pelvis and all that. Today, I have two of my FM band stations to Moody Bible Institute and WILL, the Illinois Station for Life, and they never don't have the devil's beat. Jesus' name is in it. What are they doing? It's not all dumb. They're negotiating with modernity. They're going to lose the kids if they don't make some concession. So they do it. Now, we all do that. The hardliner says, I've got to draw that line early. Make it impermeable. I must be the protector of the sacred. It can't take care of itself with other kinds of people around. We've seen that in the life of the churches. Southern Baptist Convention, Missouri Synod Lutheran. Billy Graham is a moderate in real trouble with the fundamentalists. We see it in the Christian Reformed Church, the Presbyterian Church in the U.S. Conservative bodies get hit by hardline. Liberal, they gave up on a long time ago. Gandhi is shot by them. Sadat is shot by them, hardliners. Why now? I've argued the old landmarks are dissolving. People genuinely, sincerely feel that they must be the protectors of the sacred. And indeed, anyone who's had the experience We do all those things. So we are interrelated with the sacred, and the hardliner is simply someone who says, since all the old landmarks are dissolving, there's a total threat to our identity. All that we are, all that our children are, as a group and as individuals, will be dissolved. Walter Lippmann in 1929 called it, by the acids of modernity. That are always ruining that line between sacred and profane, between us and them. We've got to draw the line and draw it early. How is this dealing with the sacred? The sacred, we said, is the limitless, and here the limits are put. The unlined and the hard line is put. The beyond all the beyonds, and very quickly you need a way to contain it. We who study the history of religion almost can predict the kind of an automatic way in that most first generations of religion are full of a sense of the sacred, erupting all over the place, boundlessly, limitlessly. You just can't contain it. It's full of paradox and ambiguity. Oh, both sides can argue. You can get words out of Martin Luther that make him sound like a modern fundamentalist inerrantist about the Bible. He carves hoc est into the table against Zwingli. They told us in school, and then he told us, don't carve anything into the table. This is my body and doesn't merely represent. Boy, he's a hardliner. And then Professor Wall, he didn't even want the book of James to be in the Bible because it didn't agree with his canon, right? Epistle of straw. You try that someday. Now, well, how can they both fit? Well, he has some other principle going. But you can't live with that very long, that immediate sense of the sacred. It didn't take long after Jesus and Paul and all those stormy people could talk their paradox. I, yet not I. Live as married as if not married. Live with possessions as if not. That is really hard stuff. So the second generation says, we've got to draw a hard line. We call it scholasticism or whatever. We have to, now all of a sudden we've got to prove the existence of God. You don't just stand there and have the sacred whomp you. You don't have the word in the scripture or the preached word, just do you. You need a theory to go with it. And every year it gets a little harder and harder and harder in that theory. And then you move quickly and say, to protect the sacred, I have to be sure that everybody else either agrees, shape up or ship out, or gets put out. And so I must either kill them, literally, as is happening in so much of the world today, or at least name them. The infidel, the great Satan, the Antichrist, the secular humanist, they. I must keep them at a distance as the profane. And the most suspect are those who do commute between the two orders. I just shot past the name Billy Graham before. Billy Graham, from some angles, would be a hardliner in that if you gave him every fundamentalist doctrine you could think of, he could say it was full integrity, yep, I agree, and they hate him. Why? He prayed at the Antichrist's inaugural 3 months ago, 4 months ago, 5 months ago. He shouldn't have been on stage with error. He won't come to Pittsburgh unless the Catholic Bishop of Pittsburgh and the Episcopal Bishop and the Presbyterian moderator and the Lutheran Bishop are up there. That's really giving it all away. That's profaning the sacred. You have to name the other. You have to suspect those who commute between the two, etc. What happens to the sacred along the way? One side of what goes on here, I think we all might say, there are reasons to appreciate, as I gave the illustration of the Soviet Union thing. I'm not always enthusiastic when people line up and say of somebody else, well, by God, at least they've got conviction. You know, the Pope and Cardinal Ratzinger are really whomping the Catholic theologian, well, at least they've got conviction. Well, Catholic theologians, they're whomping, have conviction too. By God, at least the Moonies have conviction. Yeah, sure. So did the people who had Moloch worship have conviction. Their conviction was they should burn little kids. In other words, we don't just have to admire it. We can go back with Eric Hoffer, and say some conviction in the name of protecting the sacred may have forgotten the original encounter with the sacred. I've watched the careers of numbers of television evangelists and so on who fall or who are debased or who do it mechanically. As you read their biographies, way back when, they really had the experience. They were nice kids.
They were fighting father or had a weak one. They had sinned. They went out behind the barn and had a cigarette one day. They had said, darn. Or they'd really, really done it. And they were born again. And it's a beautiful thing. Anybody who's ever had a life reorganized knows it's a beautiful thing. It doesn't take long, though, until you can start drawing the line and you forget what that original experience was. I'm going to argue in 2 days that worship, in one sense, is our attempt constantly to set up a circumstance in which we can re-confront that boundless that would reach us. And that it's very dangerous if we forget that part. So I think what we should do about this is we should examine ourselves. It's not just fundamentalists and Pentecostalists and Jehovah's Witnesses who can be hardliners. There are a lot of satires written about the kinds of places where I hang out, like divinity schools, where we have our own new orthodoxies. And you violate them, and there's a hard line, and you know right away where you are. There are liberal hardliners who also need the re-experience of the sacred. I'm trying to promote the notion tonight that the experience of the sacred does lead to conviction, but it is a conviction that is supposed to stay close to that original fire. And that means because the boundless is what would reach us, the God beyond the gods, the God in Christ who is inexhaustible but comes to us in a partly comprehensible form, is not to be taken captive in the propositions we have about them or whatever. The sacred comes in the form of personal encounter, too. It doesn't just come from the old books long written. I'm going to be a little less nice than I should be to a friend named Carl Henry for a moment to make a point. Carl Henry was the leading propositional theologian of the evangelicals, of the Billy Graham generation. He's an old man now, and he's seen evangelicalism become a lot of things. He wrote a 6-volume book against my kind of person on God only reveals God's self through propositions. When you read the Bible, it's a set of propositions, and you use logic and you analyze them. Propositions and words are the whole thing. He was against existentialism and against personalism and against experience, against all those things in the name of propositions and proof of the existence of God and proof of the truth of Scripture, proof for everything. Words are everything. And a professor at Fuller Seminary, who's on his side, reviewed the book and said the 6 volumes were demolished. Their thesis was demolished by the dedication on the first page of volume one to my wife Helga, who means far more to me than words could ever say. We've all tried that out on him, and he can chuckle a little bit along the way, too. We all have that, and he had some important things to say. But it's a way of reminding ourselves that that original experience of a word who reaches us through the preached word, through prayer, in the sacraments, can become a part of our own hardlining along the way. Tomorrow I want to take up the other side. What I didn't do tonight, and maybe it'll come out in our little remaining time for give and take, is what do we do about the other who is that way? And there I have a very realistic view. First of all, you don't lump everybody together. Everybody who's a little bit harder line than you just become hard line and you dismiss them. We remain engaged with them. You ally where you can. There could be strategic alliances for larger causes, and there you often find a common humanity and a new openness to the sacred. But on the other hand, you also have to remember you aren't going to win them all. And some people are so set in the security of the hard line that it is almost cruel to try to move them out of it. And there you have to draw a little line too. In the order of Saint Benedict, the Benedictine rule for the ancient monasteries was that let all guests be received as Christ. A beautiful motto, put it up in your home. Let all guests be received as Christ. And then Benedict has the problem of you do get some funny guests. Most notably, monks who were too argumentative in another monastery or too hard-drinking or something, and they show up, and then they want to stay. And you've just built this beautiful harmonic aura et labora, work and labor life of the Benedictines, and there you got a hardliner. And what do you do? And he says, well, you pray, Take them to chapel, you have mass, you do all that. That's supposed to rekindle the sacred. You might have to argue. We argue with them a lot. Use reason, be reasonable. He goes through a lot of steps. And then they haven't listened to prayer and they haven't listened to reason. He says, well, then what you do, and they remain contumacious and argumentative, then you get two stout monks to take them outdoors and explain the matter to them. Which is just my way of saying, his way of saying, you aren't going to win them all, so it's maybe more important to try to understand what we can understand, and then go into diagnosis and find out the places where harder lines can be of help in keeping the sense of the sacred vivid, and where are the hard lines in us where they maybe shouldn't be. The sacred still beckons us to take off the shoes from our feet, to fear not, but also to fear, and to love in a way that keeps the voice of the beyond large enough that people who are other are incorporated in it. Thank you. I'd love some good, quick give and take. We got about 15 minutes. Yes, please. Most hardliners base things on text. How much is of this is based on reading or misreading of text? All of it. because as I will argue in the worship lecture, for the believer in the traditions that most of us are most at home with, Judeo, but particularly Christian, but Islamic or whatever, all those traditions where it's easiest to be hardline start with a book. The Quran, Sharia, Torah, New Testament, or whatever. It's harder to be fundamentalist. They pull it off. It's harder to be in Buddhism where you don't need a book at all, or Hinduism where you don't know where the canon ends. It's easier to have an argument if it's a skinnier book. And the tricky part of your question, of course, is reading or misreading, because that's what the debate is about. In modern fashionable terms, a hardline religion is not hermeneutical. A hermeneutical, for those of you who are graced not to have to live in a world where they talk that way. I got through two lectures without doing it till the discussion period. Hermeneutics meant interpretation. Interpretation meant hermeneutics, but we like new words now and then, so we get the old word, hermeneutics, which is a very useful word. And it, among other things, it means that something of what you take from a text, you brought to the text. Something of the whole shape of the text, the scripture, gives alertness to the parts. I'm enjoying the struggles with the book of James here, because this Wesleyan in our midst, this hardline Wesleyan there, Professor Wall, who's teaching that book of James. He's reminding us all the time that the Bible is a library. It's 66 very diverse kinds of books, and each tradition, he's showing us how Wesleyans do it, Lutherans have a way of discerning the whole scripture. We read it all from one angle, and where the parts don't fit, you either don't let them fit, or you see it in a certain light. A great Swedish bishop once said, you're never going to understand Lutheran teaching unless it's somehow a corollary of the gospel of forgiveness of sins. And it's pretty hard to make some things come out right to that, but that's where we start. You give the text about baptism to 6 theologians who are Baptist and 6 who are Episcopalian. 20 years later, you can still tell who was where. There can be conversions, there and so on, but you can still tell that what you brought to it is part of what you bring from it. The hardliner says that's not how it is. That's not how it is. All people of goodwill who confront the text with open reason would have to come to an agreement. Now, if you're a little distance, you say, then why don't they all agree on the text? But they would say the real problem you have is once you admit that the community of interpretation does something to color what you get from a text. What I call sacred, they might call profane, because my community sees it as sacred. That's just devastating. That to them would be relativism. I don't think it is, but it introduces a relative principle. So the reading or misreading of text is much of what it's all about. Yeah. Please. Well, how do we handle the people who have a sacred base for taking books out of the library and so on? You deal with them the way James Madison said you deal with them in the Federalist Paper number 10 and 51. He said, it's nice to have a large republic. Jefferson wanted a little bitty republic of agrarians. You know, you couldn't have a republic unless everybody knew everybody. And Madison said, no, you're much safer in a great big republic. We have all kinds of factions and denominations and interests and so on. Because he said, if a conflagration breaks out in a little part of the republic, it isn't necessarily going to be a flame everywhere. Count on the jealousy of all the other interests and factions and sects to unite against them. What you're talking about are 6, 7, 8% of your community who organizes better than somebody else and takes over a school board or a library board or something one night, and there you sit, and it just means everybody else went to sleep. To me, a healthy republic is a mix of different coalitions. I like to be on the same side of the fundamentalists on some causes. In Minnesota, it was liberal feminists and fundamentalists who fought pornography. That's a pretty nice thing to fight. I want to be on their side on some things. That's what a republic is. On the next issue, you're against them or whatever. But I think we're in a moment now where that minority in America who has one kind of hard line is organized better than anybody else. And Madison say, well, the best, you better wake up. You can be overtaken and so on. Sometimes they are following a leadership that gives them signals and they just act on the signals. Some of them haven't been introduced to a larger sense of why a text might be there. And so on. Sometimes we do have texts that probably shouldn't be there for certain sets of people, like children or whatever. So I think we're in a nation now that has to learn a lot of new things about boundaries. And the hardliners have power far disproportionate to their numbers because they are intensely organized. They're protecting the sacred and they see you as profane. Yes, please.
Was Jesus a hardliner?
Jesus was a selective hardliner. Well, the model I'm giving, on one hand, he is so messy, according to gospel portraits. I always think of the Gospel of Mark, for example. I don't know who wrote it. Who wrote it? You don't know either, and you're a New Testament prof, so I don't feel bad at all. We don't know. We get a lot of different theories as to why Mark wrote the way Mark wrote, but go to your room tonight and read Mark. It takes about 45 minutes out loud, 38 minutes, something like this, and find a place where the disciples look good, right? You find a place where the disciples, they stumble all over each other, they want to sit on his right hand, they want all this stuff, and he just dumps them. And he's absolutely open to a Syrian woman and a Roman centurion. I mean, all the people who have faith are those who are, that's not hard line, I mean, that's really soft line. And the soft line of the inclusiveness of who he has banquets with, and he does those things. Hardline comes when he discerns what it is that keeps us from the kingdom. I like those two translations out of three where Jesus is dealing with the rich young ruler, two of the three translations. And Jesus, looking on the man, loved him, but said unto him, he didn't say to all rich people, you got to sell everything, but he could read in this one that unless you knew that, you'll never get to chapter 2. And that's why I think that on some levels, He is so demanding. I mean, the Sermon on the Mount, Harry Truman, my favorite modern president, once said, America would be a great nation if our laws were based on the Sermon on the Mount. You'd have 110 million amputees of right eye and right hand, and, you know, the demand is sacred, right? It is not, the Trinity had a committee meeting, 2-1, we think it'd be nice if you'd have a little seriousness about the law. No, it is written, but I say unto you, it's very hard line. And then the Sabbath is made for humans, not humans for the Sabbath, is a very soft line way to mediate it. So I think it's a very complex plot. But that's where the sacred comes in so much, as I was trying to find it yesterday. The sacred makes you tremble and it charms you. It puts you off unless you, whoever puts his hand to the plow, let the dead bury their own dead, set mother-in-law against daughter. That is pretty scary stuff. You're in range of the sacred. And then come unto me, all you that labor, is very messily soft. And I think that's the dialectic, the two-sidedness of what we try to keep with the sense of the sacred. Time for one or two more? There's one. Let me see if there are others. Two more? Okay, please.
Mm-hmm.
Is there any message in the stasis or decline of mainline and the relative prosperity of the alternatives? Yeah, there are a lot of messages, more than 6 minutes worth. But I'll hit a couple clues. One thing I do think we have to get back to is the thing I was trying to suggest earlier. Mainline learned civility and lost conviction. And hungry souls are not interested in confronting the sacred by a little dab of this and a little dab of that. You want it really to be proclaimed with clarity and asserted with vigor and lived out. I think there are wonderful things that are going on in the main line, if you want to call it that. By main line, we mean Roman Catholic, we mean Anglican, Lutheran, Presbyterian, United Church of Christ. All of these, most of them have ancestors who were established in Europe. Ever think of that? Most of the main line taxes used to pay for what you did. And after 200 years, you still think it'll be that. And the prosperous ones are those who realize you don't have the next generation unless you win your own kids and your neighbors and all the rest. The real moderns are the old-time religion. They learned right away, and so we've got to learn about 2 centuries late on that. Wonderful things go on in a lot of these mainline churches. The gospel is preached, the worship is fine, there's a community of love, the aged are cared for, there are AIDS ministries that wouldn't go on if they weren't there. There's just 1,000 things. But very often a core has caught that, but we weren't attentive to the margins of it. I think that the prosperity of the other, the simplest message, this is important, it won't come up any other time this week, so let me do it. If you drew a pie of American religion, and you asked people 30 years ago or now how you'd classify yourself by preference, by denomination or by adjective, 24% would be mainline Protestant. 8% would be African-American Protestant who share a lot with mainline in many ways, a lot of them. 3% Jewish, 8% other, 8% nothing, 25% Catholic, 22 to 24% evangelical, which includes evangelical, fundamentalist, Pentecostal, conservative, and all the rest. African-American sort of the swing vote. They're evangelical without hardline. They're not propositionalists about scripture. What's the difference is that the group called evangelical is working its one-fourth of the pie a lot better than the Catholic fourth or the mainline Protestant fourth. It isn't that a lot of people are shifting from one cohort to the other. If your parents were Episcopal, you still have a map to find the Episcopal church for your wedding. You don't turn, an individual will turn, but by and large, there's not been a move of a cohort. Some Hispanics are moving from Catholic into evangelical. But otherwise, there's very little movement. It's the mainline hasn't been successful at winning its own young on a consistent enough basis and being invitatory and so on. So conviction, I think, is a very important part of it. Last one, please.
Same question.
Well, take the rest of the evening off. We worship in 12 minutes. It's 2 minutes early. Thank you.